might as well say it in this class.
I tried to tell him in Shul that the last time we had a fast day on the 10th of the month, we didn't have to say Tachanun for 2 weeks.
Last time we had a fast day on the 10th of the month, but what are you referring to?
Yom Kippur.
Oh. You see, underneath...
It didn't go for that. I don't know why. Made sense to me.
In your pocket. And what was underneath it? There's a paper underneath it.
There's Kal Hasidim. It's Hasidus Yeshua. They always say Tachanun. They never say Tachanun. They put out a sheet each day with some Rebbe and his whole life story. They don't say Tachanun. Last Monday, they had a sheet out from some Hasidus Yeshua. It was very mocky to say Tachanun. I forgot his name. He was very mocky. He wouldn't even let a chassan come to shul during the Shavuot Brachos, so they could not say Tachanun. So for them, they said Tachanun.
Tachanun... Chassidim Dafka don't like to say Tachanun. The Rebbe explained why. Of course, it's Vachadik, and a Chassid always has a happy spirit. I write it in, I quote the Rav in the Rav, the world of. But all right, Medav Sagan Tachanun.
By Yom Medavid Elzai. This Rebbe that they had the paper last week said he would never say Tachanun on Sunday because he was still had Shabbos in him and he couldn't.
Right, that's the Amshin of what's there to be said.
And he wouldn't say Tachanun on Friday. He says because he gets so involved, he is afraid he might die and he'd be my triach the Chevra Kadisha before Shabbos to bury him.
Tachanun is. The Rambam lists Tachanun as part of a Kiyum and Shmoneh Esrei. And in Hilchot Tefillah, you can see it. That's why it's important to say Tachanun. The Rav felt that he dealt with it, that Shmoneh Esrei, you finished, you feel like you're a big shot. Tachanun brings you back to reality that you're only a frail human being. And also, Mark, I want to tell you something about Briyut. Rabbi Eisenstein is a Talmud about Rabbi Spiegel as well. Do you know him? He's younger than you, obviously. He's teaching here. He's just put out a sefer. He's a fabulous individual. So in the Sefer, he constantly is quoting Rav Abba, and he writes in the introduction that it's his Rebbe. So I was very impressed. All right, we can begin. Today is Monday, January 9th, 2017, and it's quite cold here, although not as cold as New York or Russia or Italy, for that matter. And everyone talks about global warming, but this winter has been more than par for the course. It's a very sad day. We had a tremendous tragedy here yesterday, and these tragedies weigh on us, not just losing four young lives, but what is the solution to defend ourselves against terror like this? No easy solution. I have grandchildren living literally around the corner from my grandchildren and a great-grandson, literally around the corner from where this took place. I do want to say that, Rabbi Shurin will be amazed to know that with yesterday's tragedy, there's a direct connection to this classroom. We are sitting in Yeshivas Ribbis Kol Chana, Chris Kolel, we're officially a branch, and the young man who proved to be the hero, who killed the terrorist and shot at him, the tour guide who was giving this tour, his name is Rund, R-U-N-D. His father is a Wayu Mismach. That is Ani Rund's son, the man who built the Shtiblach. That is his son who did what he did and spoke so well. So it's a very moving day and a difficult day, but we have to go further. I just want to mention that in the Sunday class, I think it was, we got involved with Shlomo Karbach and whether or not, Rav Moshe's tshuva and the Mishnah Halacha's tshuva. And it got us involved with the whole question of Karbach and the black side or the dark side or the gray side, whatever you want to call it. So I want you to know I did my homework, and not only class was class, we spoke halachically, but I went through Natan Ophir. This is the one biography we have until today of Rav Shlomo. We have two biographies, this and Dalfin, but this is the basic biography. Dalfin is more of a commentary, although I believe you have to read two of them to get a total picture. They supplement each other. So Dalfin's book, I brought to class, I quoted in class. Kalbach's book I had looked at before, but I never really went through it in detail. I went through every word, and he deals at the end with the whole question of the sexual problems. I got online from the Awareness Center. I printed out, this includes the Lilith article and includes a lot of testimony. And I just want to mention, when all is said and done, I think I portrayed Shlomo properly, correctly, and the problem is a problem. It's there. The testimony is overwhelming. It can't be swept under the carpet. I told you when you hear one story, it's one thing. When two people have similar stories, and three, and four, and five, and ultimately it's 20, and 40, and 50, where there's smoke, there's fire. And some of the testimony is very frightening, and some of the names involved, when I see Kalbach is involved with Mordechai Winiaz, Shem Rishon Yerkov, it's frightening to me. So I want to say, when all is said and done, it's a machlokes Reb Moshe and Reb Menashe Klein, and I can only tell you, Klal Yisrael has paskin to sing the nigunim fuk chazima madava. But I have to say that I sing it, but a little bit, something in me is hurt. But I can't go against Klal Yisrael. Okay, but I stand on everything I said, absolutely correct. Now, I also asked, in talking about Moshe Sherah, I asked whether his older brother, is it an older brother? Yeah, it's an older brother. I also asked whether Harry Sherah is yet alive. So Harry Sherah has to be hitting 100. I mean, I knew him he was my principal in the 40s in Salanta, let's say the late 40s. He had to be well into his upper 20s, pushing 30 then, so make the cheshbon. And he is still alive. Here is the obituary. I thank my student Leon Frager, who sent me the obituary of Harry Sherah's son. I don't want to go further, but here, if you look at his picture, weit vom Yiddishkeit is there. Alan is survived by his children, Rachel, Sophie, and Lauren, and his life partner, Wendy Mallard Gilliland. So you can draw your own conclusions, whether she's Jewish, whether their children are Jewish, his life partner. I don't have to interpret for you. So with all that being said, that answers the question, is he still alive? I also want to mention that in the latest tradition, and again, there are two articles here that really caught my attention. One, I saw a pre-publication copy, so I may have mentioned it before, but one is whether you have Birchat Kohanim on Simchas Torah. And I enjoyed that article immensely. Not that it's such a Heichet Torah issue, but I want to tell you, when I came to Maplewood, New Jersey, I'll never forget, I'm building the first Orthodox shul, I'm the first rabbi, and the first Simchas Torah, I tell the Kohanim to duchen, and the Kohanim, the few that were, said, no, in Newark we never duchened on Simchas Torah. Everyone was drunk, no one ever duchened. So then the question is, why don't you duchen in Shacharis, move it to Shacharis, or tell the Kohanim not to drink? But it seems there is a tradition in shuls not to duchen on Simchas Torah. And I have to say, I enjoyed the article immensely. There's a second article here, which I think is fabulous. It's by Jeffrey Sachs, a young man who came in Aliyah years ago, has really, really made a place for himself, found a niche for himself here. He's translating Agnon into English, and he has an article here on the relationship between Shai Agnon and Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, and that article is really, really something. So I mention it in passing. Tradition has had some very nice articles, and these two appeal to me greatly. Shayagman, because I studied English literature, I had modern Hebrew literature in college, and I read all of Agnon, and the relationship, you can comment on it, but there's one vart there that's fabulous. Shayagnon gives Rav Kook one of his early works to read, and Rav Kook reads it from cover to cover. Now he's writing a novel, right? So you understand, when people write a novel, they have to put a little bit in, make it alive, make it real, with a few chatayim that people do. So Rav Kook says to him that you do have a few things in there that I wouldn't write about, but it's, we have a klal in halacha, mit mil batel b'shishim. It's batel b'shishim of all the good things you have. Okay, now we're back here, and I want to thank all the people who have, all the Talmidim of Rav Hutna who are thanking me. You see, many Talmidim, they studied with Rav Hutna, but it doesn't mean they really knew Rav Hutna. We'll see to a certain degree that Rav Hutna kept himself a little bit, I'll come to it today, a little bit esoteric. Anyway, last week we finished up dealing with a survey of Rav Hutna's life, when we spoke about that ultimately he became the dominant figure in Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim in Berlin. All the Rashi Yeshiva had been there previously, one by one they were replaced by Rav Hutna's Talmidim. Now, and we spoke about some of the names. Rav Shurkin is a well-known name. Although Rav Shurkin, people tell me that he was pushed down. It's not that he left entirely, but he was like the Rosh Yeshiva when Chaim Berlin began. As Rav Hutna became more and more of a focal figure, Rav Shurkin was pushed aside. But he was there until the end of his life. Many people have told me that. But it's true that he was one of those, including Rabbi Snow, who we spoke about last week. So I just want to mention a little biographical note on Rabbi Wolf, on Rabbi Yisrael Snow. It's by his son Wolf Snow, and as I mentioned last week, Rabbi Snow is an uncle to Vic Snow, who finally hit Florida, so maybe his name changes to Vic Redden. Now, where do I find this biographical material? It's amazing where things pop up. The David Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies. What does it have to do with Holocaust studies? It's about people who participated in the 1943 March on Washington. The watch that I've written about and spoken about, I hold David that march was the catalyst in pushing the Rav into the world of Mizrahi from the world of Agudah. They were so disappointed how Roosevelt spat in their face that the Rav became an activist. So Wolf Snow, the son of Reb Yisrael, talks about his father. His father was born in 1913 in Brooklyn. He attended Torah Vadas Elementary School. Then he learned in Matif the Torah Vadas, but no, Torah Vadas did not have a high school. He went to the Eastern District High School in the evening. At the same time, he sold candy, gum, and newspapers in the subways of New York to help support his family. He diverted part of his money to buy boat passage to Palestine. And he studied in Hebron from 1928 to 1932. He was in Hebron during the massacres. You follow? And he studied in Palestine. That was the pool that Hebron had. That's why among the Kedoshim killed in Hebron, there were so many Americans from Torah Vadas, from YU, from Chicago, what you call Skokie today. That was the pull from all over. And then he went to Miri Yeshiva in Poland for the years 1932-1936. Then when he came back to America in 1937, he started teaching in Yeshivat Rabbeinu Chaim Berlin, where he taught until 1955. So, fascinating biographical details on Vic's uncle. In reference to the March on Washington, I remember my father telling me that they were met by Vice President Henry Wallace. The significance my father attached to this was that FDR refused to meet with them. My father attributed this to FDR's callous indifference to Jewish life and to FDR's advisors, such as Stephen Weiss, who told FDR that these rabbis were from the Middle Ages. All right, I write about this in the Silver Era, but it's exactly more or less the comment of the Rav, that I quote the Rav, I have him word by word in the Rav, where the Rav says, he sent Henry Wallace to meet with us, and everyone knows how little power a vice president has. It was just pushing us away. All right, so that's just a little addition to our description of the students of last week. But now I want to move further, and I want to introduce you. I want to go a little bit deeper now into the life of Rabbi Yitzchak Kotler. And I want to introduce you to a fabulous individual, Rabbi Dr. Hillel Goldberg. Being a Zionist, I'm not ashamed of it. I always felt bad that Hillel Goldberg left Israel. I think here in Israel, he would have achieved even more than he did than he has in America. But the story of Hillel Goldberg is very fascinating. His mother, who is over 100 years old, is Miriam Goldberg. Miriam Goldberg has won many awards. Her family, her husband, bought the Intermountain Jewish News. The Intermountain Jewish News, this is Denver, Colorado, it's that area. There always was a Jewish community in Denver. It always had very chashuv rabbanim in Denver. The reason that Denver was on the map, it was called the Jerusalem of the, what's it, the West, the Midwest, whatever the color, the Rockies, the mountains, whatever it was, that area is called, it was called the Jerusalem. The reason was that people, tuberculosis was much more common than it is today, lo aleinu. And you all know Franz Rosenzweig, tuberculosis, what took his life ultimately. And it seems the climate in Denver, because it's high on the Rockies, if I saw a baseball game there, the balls fly. It's an amazing situation. It's good for breathing oxygen lungs. So there always were Jews that were going out to Denver, among them some Jews, and they always had Choshev Rabbanim, the old time is 100 years ago. And this is where the Goldberg family comes from. Now, they took over the Intermountain Jewish News, and Max and Miriam Goldberg turned it into, they bought the paper, I think, for $1. It was bankrupt. They couldn't make any money. The owner, publisher, was happy to sell it, get someone, you know, to see it. Instead of going mahula and disappearing, they were happy to sell it for $1. You can correct me if I'm mistaken, but no, it's for $1. And Miriam in particular, Max died young. Miriam took over the paper, and she really turned it into a living venture. Now, I gather, and again, I can stand to be corrected because there's no real biography on Hillel Goldberg, but from my acquaintance with Hillel, I gather that the family was more traditional than strictly Orthodox. He wound up in the Boston area studying. He wound up getting a doctorate from Brandeis. He spent some time at Yeshiva University. He comes to Israel. I believe it was the Boston Rebbe that picked him up. And you all know in Boston, there were two great shining lights, Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, the Boston Rebbe. I don't believe the Rev picked up many students in college, in the surrounding colleges, but the Boston Rebbe did. And when he picked them up, they were obviously exposed to the Rev as well. And I also know that Hillel studied in Yeshiva University for a while because something very amazing happened in this building in the early 80s. In the early 80s, it was 100 years since Rabbi Yisrael Salanter died. And Rabbi Moshe Horowitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, in the auditorium here, we held a memorial. We were more community conscious. YU in general is more community conscious. It had an alumni division here. They had a secretary here. They put a little money into it. I hope under the next president, under our own Ari Berman, Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, things will get a little bit better here. I have my own plans, but okay. I talk, everyone listens to me very respectfully. I might as, but then when I walk away, I realize I might as well have been speaking to the wall. So, you know, I recognize that Rakefid is Rakefid, but as long as I'm gesund, no one is going to slap my face. But when they walk away, you know, they laugh and that's it. Okay, anyway, so we had a public session in memory of Rav Yisrael Salanta. And Whitey Horowitz hit upon two speakers. Who were the two speakers? Yours truly. What was my connection? Well, Yitzhak Rubin, Rabbi Rubin will test on. Rabbi Rubin, you should know, emails came in from the world how people want to meet you. They were. You have to see some of the emails. I can't show them because they're too complimentary. It's not nice. But females come in, they want to meet you, they want to meet you. So Rabbi Rubin will testify, we were Talmidim of Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessin. And how does Hillel Gerberg fit in? He did his doctorate on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter at Brandeis. So both of us get up to speak, and who are we talking about? Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessin, the great influence that the Mashgiach of the Yeshiva University had upon us. And Hillel and I embraced in public. We never knew that we were both greatly influenced by the same individual. Hillel is younger, so it was a later period. It had to be, if Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessin died in 75, so it had to be Hillel, I was influenced in the 50s, and Hillel the 60s into the 70s, perhaps. So it was really an amazing evening. And he called himself, he told me he's a late bloomer. He began late, he began learning late, but he is an amazing individual, and I have to give credit in addition to his work on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. A copy of it is available in the Torah Shraga office. I saw it. In addition to his work on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, a few years ago, he put out a lumdisha work on Hilchot Nida, the Haggad of the Gra to the Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya. And he worked on it for years. I mean, this is sitting up. So why did he have to leave Israel? Because when his mother aged and she felt, you know, and anyone here over 70 knows what I'm saying. Those of you that haven't hit 70 yet, halavai, you should hit, and on and on. I'm already hitting beyond 70. But when you age, you just don't have the energy. Like people bothering me to give lectures here, there, everywhere. I tell everyone the only place I lecture is Griscola. You want to hear me? Come to Gris. No one comes to. No one knows where Gris is. That's a different story. This is so far off, and no one knows where it is. I was just speaking with someone yesterday, and he didn't even know where Machon Lev is. So how do you expect them to know where Gris is? But you don't have the energy. So his mother asked him to come back and take over the newspaper. And Hillel went back, and he lives in Denver, where he took over the newspaper. And even there, how he does it, I don't know, but he's a member of Agudat Yisrael. On the other hand, he built a mikveh in a Reformed temple. You understand? This is Hillel Goldberg. He's capable of reaching out to different worlds. Kol hakavod to him. Now, why am I telling you all this? Very simple. Look, people who have a tendency to write, or have the ability to write, or have that Yetzahara to write, call it what you wish. So you should know. You write, I'll talk about myself. I don't know, I've published thousands of pages. But it's not all on the same level. Certain things you publish on one level, certain things are on another level. It's like shayurim. The Rav gave shayurim. I can't say every bakasha, join us. I can't say every shir that the Rav gave was on the same level. Some were fantastic and some were just fabulous. That's the nature of the beast. I once heard someone said to me, one thing about your shiurim, he said, they're always good. Some are fab, but there's always something you can learn. It's not minfumfnisht. If you know Yiddish, I don't want to elaborate. Minfumfnisht. Okay, true. I want to tell you, Hillel Gerberg has published the great book. I consider his greatest publication his essay on Rav Huttner. No one ever got it better than Hillel Gerberg. Now, this essay appeared in Tradition, winter 1987. It later appears in a volume where he put his essays together. You may be familiar with it. It's called From Slabodka to Berlin. Are you familiar with it there? So he has many essays on people who wound up from Eastern Europe and wound up in Berlin, wound up in the big world. The essays are fascinating, but none of them equal Rabbi Isaac Huttner, a synoptic interpretive biography. Okay, now, and how he catches Rav Huttner. So I want to begin and use this essay for who is Rav Huttner? Who was he? I'll make you a Xerox. Remind me after class, okay? And I have my pen down here. Remind me after class, don't forget. I'm sure I can make you a Xerox. Okay, now, who was Rav Huttner? And why do we have a problem? Why there was the early Rav Huttner, the later Rav Huttner, the exoteric Rav Huttner, the esoteric Rav Huttner. Rav Huttner, and I'm quoting him, generally when I cite sources, I summarize them. Here I want you to hear his words. Rabbi Huttner embodied a problem. How can contrary, even contradictory systems of thought and life mesh without eclectic blending or oscillation between poles? If the answer cannot be logical, it can be phenomenological, the complex and straightforward Vasher Eloi, Warsaw prodigy himself, born in 1906, soon to become a renowned Talmudist, right? That's the first level of Rav Huttner. Right or wrong, Torah Tanazir was a Litvish Talmud Chacham. But he was a poet, a philosopher, a pietist, an egoist. The man had a self-image. The Rosh Yeshiva, we'll get to that, right or wrong. An intellectual, a humorist, could tell a good joke, a good story, and a private person, and a public persona, a lover of Zion. And at the same time, an anti-Zionist, right or wrong, we spoke about that. And personally liberal and pragmatically conservative, and devotee of the towering opponent of Hasidicism, the Vilna Gaon, and a practitioner of Hasidicism itself, right or wrong, later in life, Agatel, the Bekesha, the Shtickel Shtreimel. Rabbi Huttner once commented autobiographically on a rabbinic midrash and Adam. And now he's quoting Rav Huttner word by word. Adam, it says, was created from earth, gathered from all over the world, right or wrong. Isn't that the midrash that when the Ribbono Shel Olam made Adam HaRishon, he took earth from all over the world? I too am a gathering point. From Poland, from Lithuania, from Riga, from Germany, from Eretz Yisrael, from the United States. And by the way, anything I quote, if you take the article, the sources are all there. A panorama of influences impinging on radical autonomy entailed still another pair of contrary impulses, self-revelation and self-concealment. Revelation of self was possible because there was so much colorful and diverse baggage that Rabbi Huttner could set forth layer after layer without ever reaching the bottom layer. Yeah, follow me, this man could give Shayurim, Shas, Paiskim, Rashi, Tosfot, Rambam, Ravid, Reb Chaim. I still remember when I visited Chaim Berlin, what I write about in Washington. Is that the book you're holding there? Hold it up so the world should know there is such a volume. From Washington Avenue to Washington Street. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I write about it when I visited, what is Yiddishkeit? So I remember I came into Chaim Berlin and a kid I knew from Bnei Akiva was working with Chiddushei Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi on HaRambam. But the same Rav Huttner, Machshava, Maharal, total philosophic personality, his Maimarim, and captivating friendliness went hand in hand with unstated but clear prohibition of excessive familiarity to his person, such that the more one knew him, the less one knew him. This is magnificent. Like, the more one knew him, the less one knew him. And similarly, the more one probes his writings, all of which he structured in both form and content with a clear definitiveness, the less one is certain of the ultimate perspective of the constellation of thought therein. Yitzchak Kuttner, like all transition figures, is an enigma. In this case, the quandary is deepened because we know so much about him. In other words, we know so much, and yet we know so little. Who was he? Who was he? So many countries. See, it's not like the Rav. You say the Rav also was a transitional figure. Brisk, Kruzhana, Haslovich, Warsaw, Berlin, Boston, New York, absolutely. But you knew the Rav inside out. I have to tell you, all these volumes that came out about Rebbe, it's some of those volumes, some of the articles, it's people describing themselves and saying, I got this from Rav Soloveitchik. You understand? The Rav, there's no question who he was. He was a Litvak who chose to live in the less Western world. If I can quote the Rabbaran Lichtenstein, Rabbaran's words, a Litvak who embraced the Western world with two hands. I think that's a beautiful apt description of the Rav. What Rabbi Braunschweigel said, I never saw the Rav holding a secular book. There's a bit of truth to that in the sense that the Rav's basic essence was Shas Paiskim. I told you more than once, there was a Rav in RCA, well-known rabbi, no longer alive, from Chicago, raised fine children. One of his sons learned in Lakewood many years. So the Rav meets the son at an RCA convention. He comes with his father, and the Rav says to the father, with your son, it's a pleasure to speak and learn. He is a Talmud Chacham. You understand? So you would say, Rebbe, what are you so happy about? The guy didn't go to college, the guy didn't go to university. Although I think later he did go to college. He's a Rav, he's an Abbeitin today, he's Masada Gittin. We've corresponded over the years. This captures the Rav. The unterste Shura, the bottom line, is a Litvak. And not only that, the Rav revealed himself in public. He's also amazing about the Rav. He was a private person. When you're in the limelight, you have to build a barrier around yourself or the world is going to knock you over. But when the Rav gave a shiur in public in front of hundreds, later thousands of people, he would speak about his wife, he would speak about his children, he would speak about his father, speak about his mother, speak about his innermost feelings and expressions. On that level, the Rav was more public than any other Rebbe I ever had. And that was in public. It was an amazing thing in front of thousands of people. The Israeli population, you should know, I'm going back now to the 50s, the 60s, so I would get the Israeli newspaper, weekly magazine, it was a magazine, newspaper, it was Ayin Bayin, then it was Panim Al Panim. So I remember when they were writing up the Rav, they said the Israelis have trouble understanding him because he's so human. Israeli Rashi Yeshiva, I don't know today, but at that time they were like semi-gods. There was nothing human about them. They never revealed their innermost feelings. It's like a Chassidic Rebbe. There was a wall around them. We found out when we came in Israel. I'll never forget Avram Silbert. I write about it in Washington. Avram Silbert, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, told me in 1969, you can't be an American Rebbe here. If you don't play basketball with your own students, you understand, it was totally different than, and thank God I didn't listen to him. Of course, the Ribbono Shel Olam was kind to me, BMT opened, and here I found a place where I could be half Israeli and half American and translate the two into one synthesis. But This is so insightful. Rav Chutna was a transitional figure, but we don't really, who was he? What was he? And you can peel away layer and layer and layer, and you still don't get who was Rav Chutna. Very insightful. Then he speaks about, I'm quoting now from Hillel Goldberg's article. He speaks about the two great influences on Rav Chutna. And look, there's no question that in the Litvische Welt, the greatest influences on you are the Rebbeim in your youth. I've always said that a Litvak, and the Rav said this, I don't have to quote them, Rakefet, who is he? You can quote the Rav, it's more important. The Rav said this too. We only have a Rebbe once. When we're young, we have Rebbeim. Their influence remains for life. The Rav, after his wife died in his famous talk, Yutet Kislev, it was 68. I heard the talk, there's a tape of it. It's not a clear tape, but you can make it out. Do you want to ask a question, Jonathan? I cut you off.
It's just more, at least from my generation, even people who are call themselves many Jewish historians or whatever that actually means, the Rav is the most complicated figure for people to really understand.
It's only complicated because they didn't know the Rav.
Right, no, so I'm just saying, for this generation.
No, it's not complicated. I've read their complications on Narishkeit. The Rav, we who knew him intimately, it was so easy to understand. It was beautiful. I mean, I learned by Rabbaron Cutler. There, I write about it in Washington. I told you, if you're not familiar with Washington, you don't know how to breathe there. Friday, we used to have off, right, in the afternoon. You only had Seder in the morning. So I once bought a New York Times. I was a very poor kid. I didn't have money. It's not that like kids today have money. Like my grandchildren have a good grandfather who gives them whatever they want. Thank God I can, but within reason. But I think it was 2 cents or 3 cents. So I go for a walk Friday afternoon, and I leave the New York Times on my bed in the dormitory. I come back, the New York Times is ripped up and in the garbage. Follow me? That was Lakewood. I come to YU, Rabbaron and the Rav, I don't want to say who could learn better. All right, they were equal. Let's put it that way. A Lakewood guy will say Rabbaron was the bigger Talmud Chacham, a YU guy will say the Rav was the bigger Talmud Chacham. They were way beyond us. We can't decide. You follow what I'm saying? But the same Rav who could give an unbelievable shiur would quote from the New York Times. You follow me? And it was fabulous for me. I never had a conflict. My chinuch was so natural, so beautiful. Never a conflict, complemented, supplemented. And that's the Rav talking to your Rebbe, where everyone was hysterical when he told the story during the Shleishim that the Rav says to Rabbi Braunschweigel, you should get a doctorate. Remember that or not? You should get a doctorate. And the audience broke into laughter because Rabbi Braunschweigel was very far from get a doctorate. But that was the Rav. Rabbaron Lichtenstein finishes college and let's say he asked the Rav, Rebbe, what should I do now? Go to Lakewood or go to Harvard? Go to Harvard. Didn't mean Rabbaron stopped learning. He learned a private shiur every week with the Rav. But learn day and night, Rabbi. What, he got a doctorate from Harvard? Okay, and we can go further, but leave it for now. All right, now, the influence...
What was the address in 1968, you said?
At Yutet Kislev in Boston. Yeah. So the Rav cried and said, I was just going to say it, he envies Chassidim who always have a Rebbe. And he says, if I would have a Rebbe today, I could share my heartache. He would join with me. He would take away some of the heartache. But I'm a Nebuch, he's not a Chassid. So you see, a Chassid can be influenced. I give you a simple example. The Lubavitcher Rebbe becomes Rebbe 1951 officially. They finally, you remember my lectures, they finally pressure him and he agrees. People stand before him in their 70s, 80s, 90s, b'dechilu urechimu. This is a Rebbe, he knows kol haTorah kulo ba'al peh. They're impressed, they're overwhelmed, they're inspired. A Litvak can never have that feeling. He's always going to view the kid standing in front of him, 29 years old, who taka no shas and paiskim. Vi kumta to Rav Soloveitchik. How does he come to Rav Soloveitchik? How do you compare him to a Baron Kotler? That's a Litvak. So here, Hillel Goldberg tells us two people had influence on Rav Putnam. Who were his rebbeim? The Alter of Slabatka and Rav Avram Yitzchak, a Kohen cook. Now, the description of the Alter and Rav Cook, and you can see their influence upon Rav Hutna. The Alter, let me give you a little bit background of the Alter. And here you have the greatest work on the Alter of Slabatka is Making of a Gadol by Reb Nissim Kamenetsky. It's a shame that that book, it should be reissued and it should be edited. You know my Vatna Reb Nissim's book. I say you have to read it like a Daf Gemara. There's Gemara, there's a super commentary, and there are footnotes. It's like Gemara, Rashi, Tosfot. Are you going now, Natanok? I said, I don't have to say goodbye. Okay, it's got three different layers. It's confusing at times. Someone should take the volume and redo it, but redo it in a way that it flows, that you don't have to have the basic text, the enlarged text, and the footnotes at the bottom. But there you get a fabulous picture of the Alter of Slabatka, because Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was a Talmud Mufak of the Alter of Slabatka. Now, let me just give you a few details on Rabbi Netan Zvi Finkel. Here's what's amazing about his life. He had no private life. His entire life was the Slabatka yeshiva. He lived in the yeshiva. He went home for Shabbat and for Yom Tov. Otherwise, rooming and boarding with his own students for 25 years, returning to his wife and family for a few short periods yearly, not even every Shabbat. So on one hand, here you have this man who simply isolated himself from the maelstroms of life, and he was a fabulous individual in Chinuch, that he related to every Talmud individually. He knew what your strengths were, what your weaknesses were. Sometimes he was Makarev, someone who needed a compliment. Sometimes he saw someone was a bit of a Baal Gaiva and he put him down. He had tremendous Kochat HaChinuch. And you can see it, he raised so many great Talmidim, and yet they were very different. We mentioned two names, Rav Aaron Kotler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, totally different. Rav Yaakov Ruderman, different. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, all right, there's an entire story. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg started to... He was once, do you know the story? I don't want to repeat it if you know it, but it's an unbelievable story. Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg was the biggest Eloi of the yeshiva world, of the Litvisha world, 115 years ago. There was no mind that equaled the mind of Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Weinberg. One time he was traveling, he had gone home to visit his parents, coming back to the yeshiva, and he had to change trains. And there were no Jews around to help him. He couldn't speak Russian. And he wound up taking the wrong train, had to change, had to wait. He lost the full day out of his life because the trains did not run that often. And he had to wait for the next train going to where he wanted to go. He made up his mind that he has to learn Russian. My grandfather came from Russia to America, a teenager. My grandfather, till the day he died, the only language he spoke was Yiddish. Didn't learn English, didn't know any Russian. I once asked my grandfather, how could you live in Russia and not learn the language? And my grandfather said, all we had to know was da, niet, yes and no, and I had to curse them in Russian. And I know I can curse in Russia like a sailor. Take my word for it, it came in very, very handy in Riga, but that's not for now. Also in the army, in basic training, I can understand all the curses going on, the Arabic, the English, and Russian. There are no curses in the Hebrew language. Any curse you will think of, I told you, is a halakhic concept. Ben nida, ben zona. It's a halakhic concept. What do you want? Entire sukkahs, yavama, ketuva, last parak of kedushin. But you could live in Russia and not know the language. He made up his mind he has to learn Russian. When he started to learn Russian, he became interested in the greater culture. And the Altar of Slabodka was very worried that Reb Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg will leave the yeshiva and become a maskil. There were many examples of people who studied in Telz and Slabodka, not too many from Mir, you should know, but Mir really goes on the map after World War I. And by that time, you didn't have too many maskilim leaving the yeshiva. They saw what Haskalah led to. They were more diffident. But he was worried, 1900, 1905, 1907, that Rebbe Chiya Yaakov will become a maskil. So a Rav, a Shtot Rav, died. It's like Elizabeth, New Jersey. If you know the story of Elizabeth, how Rabbi Teitz comes there, Rabbi Prell died. He had a daughter who wasn't married. They announced whoever will marry the daughter will inherit the rabbinate. That's how Rabbi Teitz, who was a beautiful marriage, don't misunderstand me, and she was a very elegant lady. Wow. Teitz, his wife, I think her name was Bessie, if I'm not mistaken, but it can be checked out. And Chatz Rabbi Chiel Yaakov married the girl, the daughter, the Alter made the Shidduch, and the Shidduch didn't succeed. Rabbi Chiel Yaakov was a brilliant individual, didn't work out. Don't take it as any negative comment about the girl, the lady. I heard from people when I came to Israel, I told you I saw right away back in 1969, I'll never make a living here, but I wanted to No Kol HaTorah Kula, and I interviewed anyone and everyone from Germany, from Lita, anyone I could speak to. So I spoke with Talmid and Rabbi Chiel Yaakov. They say it was Rabbi Chiel Yaakov's fault. He was not ready for marriage yet. And she later marries, and she lived in Eretz Yisrael, and there are endless hundreds of direct descendants from this lady, Alad Mata Kodesh. But Rabbi Chiel Yaakov, that was the Slabodka's mistake, that shidduch. He did remain Rabbi Chiel Yaakov, but he winds up in Berlin, he leaves Eastern Europe, and he becomes the Sri Deyesh, the PhD, head of Hildesheimers, and all that we've spoken about maybe 20 years ago when we spoke about Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg.
Did he ever remarry?
No, he never remarried. He remained a bachelor. It's a sad story. After World War II, he survived with miracles, and his top Talmud of the 1930s, Reb Shaul Weingott, took him in and built him a mother-daughter arrangement and said, Rebbe, this is your home. And 1 year later, Reb Shaul Weingott, on his way to give shir in the yeshiva in Monterey, was killed by a trolley car that hit him. And Rabbi Chiel Yaakov, the Flabiyuta family, says he must remain, and he raised Rabbi Shaul Weingott's son, Rabbi Avram Abba Weingott, became the son he never had. And Rabbi Abba Weingott, a Rav Doctor, is one of the great teachers, lovers of Torah in the state of Israel today. Okay, now, so you see, there was something else about the Mashgiach, about the Alter of Slabodka. He kept a very low profile. you never knew that he was the power behind the throne. There were Rashi Yeshiva, world famous Rashi Yeshiva in Slabodka, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Lavush Mordechai. But whenever it came to an essential question, he sent you to the Mashgiach. So you see, this was one influence on Rav Hutna. The ability to limit yourself, to cut back on your public posture. E.g., his sichat, he had to invite you. You couldn't come in if you weren't a Talmud of his. He didn't allow outsiders in. When he first started publishing, all his original publications outside of Torah Tanazia were done anonymously. You follow? His work afterwards, his sichot, whatever he published, the Maimarim, it was Talmidim writing up something they heard from a Rebbe. His name was not attached to it. He kept a certain diffidence, a certain hestapanim. He didn't say everything that was on his mind. He limited himself. There was a reflection of the Alta of Slabodka. On the other hand, you take Rav Kook. Rav Kook was exactly the opposite. Totally public figure, overflowing, touching every aspect of Torah in public. Rav Kook, you see the publications that we have come up with. He never stopped to edit anything. Constantly being Mechadesh, Shas, Poskim, Halacha, Tshuva, philosophy, Agada, current events. There wasn't an area where Rav Kook didn't speak, didn't overflow. The greatest problem with editing Rav Kook's writings, and you can all check it out with all the introductions, whenever writings come up, he never redid it, he never corrected it, he never reworked it, he never polished it. He went on and on, there was so much to give. Tell you a Meir Dikvart. Who knew Rav Kook from the old country? Chaim Nachman Bialik. How did they know each other? Natan, they learned in the Lashon at the same time. Any of you who have studied Rav Kook, have studied Bialik's masterpiece, Hamatmid, who is he describing? All the followers of Merkaz HaRav would tell you he's describing Rav Ram Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. We'll never know for sure. Mori, there are other theories of who he was describing. We'll never know for sure. But certainly, Rav Kook was a prototype that Bialik knew well. So one time they asked Bialik, this is fabulous, they asked him, Chaim Nachman, who writes Hebrew better? Who flows better? You or Rav Kook? And he answered, on the first draft, Rav Kook is much better than I am. But he doesn't come back to it. I rework it. I edit it. My finished product is better than Rav Kook.
There's Rav Kook is writing
the Ruach
HaKodesh.
No.
He wanted to rework it.
Please don't bring in your Hasidic thinking.
It's like
now.
He describes himself.
Try to understand these are two Litvisha guys.
He's not Litvish. Rav Kook was a Hasidic Rebbe.
No, and Rav Kook has Hasidic background. That's for
all
sure.
All of his Torah is mystical, visionary consciousness.
There's no question that what you're saying is right. But the basic gestalt of Rav Kook was more Litvish, was more of a Lashon. That's where it all began. It's like the Rav, Chaim Dalfin is, you know what we said. Chaim Dalfin tries to show the Rav later became a synthesis with Hasidus. I don't agree. Yeah, not a synthesis. I say it was icing on the cake. But okay, we can disagree. It's fine. But
you can't write Uwe Kashtin Yishan.
But
the Ala Tshuva, give those drushes.
Well, no, Beseda, Ala Tshuva is more Litvish, I think. Okay, but This too influenced Rav Hutner. You see, he flowed. He went to areas where Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky got involved with the Maral, got involved with Machshava. Rav Moshe Feinstein went into these areas. Rav Hutner was unique, and he overflowed. It was flowing. It was chiddush. It was available to his Talmidim. It was not as public as Rav Kook, who was available to everyone. But Rav Yitzchak Hutner, this was the gestalt that he contributed to his Talmidim. This was the image they saw. The man overflowed, went way beyond Shas and Paiskin. And that you have to contribute to Rav Kook. Very insightful. The Alta, Rav Kook, the influence. Now, he leaves for Berlin, 1929. And he's been in Warsaw, he's been in Israel, he's now in Berlin. And I want to quote to you Rav Hutner speaking about himself. This is so true. And the source, you'll check everything. All the sources are in the footnotes. A lot of it appears in the Pachat Yitzchak, by the way, in the biographical session. Every place where I arrive, even as but a passing guest, I take root at once. I become a citizen in the land, in the environment. Naturally, that makes me parting seven times more difficult. Am I then to be counted among the righteous who lack tranquility in both this world and the next? I begin to feel a little bit proud. It's a very fascinating quote. How many of us take root right away? How many of us, we changed, we came and speak about myself now, came in Aliyah. Took many years till I became an Israeli. Today I'm an Israeli, no two ways about it. I think in Hebrew, I dream in Hebrew, many words, I'll say the Hebrew word before the English word, I understand the Israeli mentality, for better, for worse. It takes a long time. The Rav comes to Boston. How many years did it take until he mastered what America was all about, the Western world, and where he belongs? It took at least 10 good years. Rav Hutner had the ability, wherever he went, he immediately took root. It goes back to the original quote, that I have a little bit of all the different lands in my body. I'm a little bit, my blood is from Warsaw, Lithuania, Slabodka, Chevron, Yerushalayim, Berlin. Amazing. When he comes to America, remember what we said? Within 1 year, clean shaven, dress, modern dress, kurtze begodim, short clothes as we call it, speaking almost the perfect English. Just think about it. Now, Berlin, he got involved with Chochmat Yisrael, and you can't escape this. Other people were doing great things already. Shaul Lieberman, Slabodka Yeshiva boy, was already involved in Yerushalmi, Tosefta, scientific Jewish scholarship, editing, Greek and Latin. Those of you that have used Rav Lieberman's Tosefta, his knowledge of Greek and Latin, fabulous. Yerushalmi in interpreting difficult words. You have Harry Wolfson, Slabodka Yeshiva boy, involved in the greatest, may have been the greatest general philosopher, a history of philosophy, understanding philosophy, comparing general philosophy with Torah philosophy, with the Rambam, with Moreh Nevuchim. Who is Harry Wolfson? He was a living legend. By the way, he never married. Never married. And I heard stories from Ede Ria that he will, where was he teaching Harry Wilson? In Harvard, right? And they tell stories that like Thursday night after a hard week of teaching, of writing, of learning, of scholarship, he'd go to the movies. No, Harry Wilson would go to the movies. All right, how a movie, how deep is it? And in the morning when they would come to clean out the movie, they would find him asleep in his chair. That's so they claim these stories are true. I'm not, you heard the story before?
They heard it from you.
No, you heard it from me. No, but this, I heard it from like ear witnesses and eyewitnesses. That was Harry Wilson. How firm did he remain? Did he remain a Shomer Shabbos? I mean, Liebman, there's no question, remained a tzaddik b'chol ma'asav. But Wolfson, I don't know. But Wolfson knew the Rav. You know, they had a relationship and mutual respect. But how do we know?
Wasn't Yitzhak Twersky his student?
Yeah, Yitzhak Twersky, not only his student, the Yitzhak Twersky, there was a trade-off. Wolfson appointed him to the Harvard faculty, and that and Arthur Hyman, who was also a student of Harry Wolfson, was appointed to the JTS faculty. And or he was a JTS, no, he was studying with Wilson. He was appointed to the Bernard Revel faculty. And Arthur Hyman went on to teach at Bernard Revel, I think, longer than anyone else, ultimately becoming dean. He's in well into his 90s today.
And I think
he's still teaching.
Is he still teaching? I had a class with him a few years ago.
Halavai, halavai. I was in his very first class in Bernard Revel Graduate School.
Wow.
And I'll tell you something, Mark, you know the players, Teddy Parnas, Rabbi Parnas, right? You yet remember what the yeshiva was, Rabbi Parnas. So Rabbi Parnas sat in on the very first class he gave. So I asked Teddy, I said, why did you sit in? Why are you wasting your time? You know, he's not a student. He said he wanted to see whether there was epicursus. You know, in other words, here's a guy from JTS and Harry Wolfson in common. But I want to tell you, he was totally textual. I never heard a word from him. I studied with him at least one or two courses. I don't remember exactly, and as a human being, he was very nice. And he never, ever, the text was what he taught you. Am I right or wrong? Yeah, Alex, in your time too. So, but you see, who gets involved in Chachmat Yisrael, editing the Sifra, editing the Rishonim? Remember we spoke? This is Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner. It had an impact on him. You didn't just go to Berlin and imagine in Berlin you meet Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. You didn't just go to Berlin to not be influenced by some of the great happenings that were taking place there. And here you want to hear, Hillel writes, the manuscript that he worked on of Hillel of Verona's 13th century commentary on Sifra, on Vayikra, the manuscript was written in Italian script. It was a different script than the Hebrew we write, which Isaac Kuttner taught himself by comparing passages from the Talmud, quoted in the manuscript with the Talmud itself, until he was able to study it as easy as a printed book. Very, very fascinating that he was able, in other words, it's like my wife says when you have a difficult ktav yad, try to take a word you understand, and see how he writes an aleph, a bet, a gimel. Were you sure that's an aleph, bet, gimel? That's how you master the ktav yad. And this is exactly what Rav Kuttner did. And this was all in Berlin. Later, he completes the work in the United States, but it's published and until today, and he publishes it anonymously. His name is not on it, which also becomes very interesting. Now, there's another part to this. Here the Rebbe was in Berlin. So I told you my conversation with Rebbe, the Avodat HaMelech. Remember I said to Rebbe, I had chutzpah already, but in 1983, I knew the Rav for many decades, and he knew me for many decades, and I could have a little bit chutzpah. So I said to the Rav, Rebbe, your uncle quotes you in the Avodat HaMelech, you were looking at manuscripts for him in the bibliothek, in the library in Berlin. Chochmat Yisrael. So the Rav, I'll never forget, his eye, he was an old man already, not in good health, his eyes lit up. He quotes me, tells me, I said to him four times, he said to me six times, Klausner, my Talmud, the Harav Yedidja Klausner, found eight times. I believe in the Rav. I have eight different places where I cook. So, but here there is a tremendous difference, and you start to see the difference in lifestyles that so impacts upon their public gestalt between the Rav and Rav Hutner. And I mean, I make the point, but Hillel Goldberg makes the point here too. Rav Hutner constantly hid from the world his broader interests. He didn't want you to know what he did in Berlin, how hard he worked to publish this manuscript of Rabbeinu Hillel on Sifra, published the volume anonymously, unlike the Rav, that everyone knew he went to Berlin. Everyone knew he got a doctorate in Berlin. Everyone knew he wanted to write on the Rambam and Aristotle, and there was no one at the University of Berlin who could guide such a doctorate. So he wound up writing on Hegelian thought.
Hermann
Cohn. Yeah, I know. Hermann Cohn, going back to Kant and Hegel and Hermann Cohn's take on it. I have a nice, when I describe the Rav's doctorate in the Rav, I have a nice translation of the German. How do I know it's nice? Because when I came in Aliyah and I started dubbing an old Rivka, I used to sit next to Ezreel Hildesheimer, Zichrona Levracha. What was my connection to Ezreel Hildesheimer? He was married to Rabbi Revel's niece. So Dr. Ezreel Hildesheimer was a rough guy. And everyone in the shul couldn't understand. He is so nice to me and so respectful. I finally told them, yeah, I wrote, if not for my work on his uncle, I didn't know yet then that Rabbi Revel was my cousin. That's I'm only going to find out many decades later. But if not for my work on Rabbi Revel, his name would be, that was his uncle, his name would be forgotten. So he once looked at my work. He worked out, I have my house. Ezreel Hildesheimer published a list of all the students that they could ascertain studied in Hildesheimer. So in that list, he also mentions the Rav, not as a student, but as someone who was in close contact with many of the Hildesheimer faculty. He might have ordered some classes. So he wanted to see my work on the Rav and how I described that period. And he says to me, oh, your translation into English from the German is excellent. I forgot already who helped me. I don't think I knew German that well that I could do such an excellent translation. But I picked it up or worked on it or fine-tuned it, but the Rav never hid. This was part of his persona. What a difference between Rav Hutner and Mori Rebbe as time marches on. Now, his coming to America was very fascinating. What America did for him, what he did for America, why America was unique, why he fit into America. And now I want to quote Rav Hutner. Hillel Goldberg is quoting Rav Hutner. And so he wrote in 1934, I am now on my way to America. Here I am on the ship sailing to New York. In these last years, I have been swept by the flux of events in my life, wave after wave, journey after journey, migration upon migration, and have known no rest. And what is he referring to? Berlin, Hebron, Yerushalayim, Warsaw. I've had no rest. all these journeys, migrations, travels, all that probing inside and outside of myself were nothing other than the result of an inner urge disturbing my peace, consuming me with its flames, beating my back with 1,000 hammers, and grabbing my head by its tails, goading me to find the way to myself by myself. I must create even the first stalks with my own hands. End quote. Now, this is a very powerful description.
What language did you say that in originally? Is that English?
The quote is in English, yeah.
You wrote that in English.
Let me see. Let me check. 24 footnote. Let's see what he refers you to. You see, when the footnotes are in back, it's so much harder, but it's cheaper to publish that way. Yeah. That's the secret. Zichronot. So it's in the Pachat Yitzchak. It's probably a quote from Hebrew translated into English. That's what I would imagine, because the Zichronot, I'll tell you about the Zichronot when I finish Goldberg. The Zichronot are in Hebrew. Now, you see, this takes me back to a different story. Let me make a little comparison. Two stories. One hurts me and one is funny. The funny one is very simple. We just spoke about Rabbi Chiyuh Yaakov Weinberg. I never met Rabbi Chiyuh Yaakov Weinberg, but I have to admit I feel as if I knew him, because I know so many of his students, knew so many of his students so well. I mean, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, we became very friendly, and he really let down his hair with me and told me stories about Rabbi Chiyuh Yaakov, including his marriage, and I can't repeat some of it, just can't mouth some of the words, but don't blame his wife for the fact the marriage didn't work out. Not every man is capable of marrying and all that goes with it. Okay. So Rabbi Chiyuh Yaakov Weinberg spends his years in Switzerland. Now, with all due respect to Switzerland, do you think they needed a gaon like Rabbi Chiyuh Yaakov Weinberg in Switzerland? Now, let's be honest. Rabbi Herzog was called Chief Rabbi of Ireland, remember? And people who knew Ireland, it's like being chief rabbi of a young Israel. You follow? What are we talking about? All right. Chief rabbi of London may already be. You did have some London there, but Ireland. So they asked Rabbi Chiyuh Yaakov, why are you remaining? And he was a Zionist after World War II, Palestine, Eretz Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael. And you know his famous answer, my Talmud, Max Shapiro, quotes it, that I must stay in Switzerland. Here I can do whatever I want. If I go to Israel and I teach in Hebron Yeshiva, remember the quote? Hebrew University is going to laugh at me. If I teach in Hebrew University, Hebron will put me into Hebron. I can't win. Here I can do whatever I want. There's a lot of truth with the Rav as well. When Mr. Gruss, and because of him we're only sitting here, when Mr. Gruss built this beautiful campus for the Rav, all right, the Rav told him, you got to understand, he pressured the Rav. There's a unique relationship there, and it's not so simple. The Gadol Hador, and you're dealing with someone who is the Gadol Hador, and money being given to Chinuch. Mr. Gruss said to me, quote, I want to die without a penny to my name. I gave my children enough. They're taken care of. I want to give it all away for Jewish education. And one time I was talking with Mr. Gris, and a kid walks by with payas, and he said to me, das ist die Zukunft, die Kinderlach mit der Payaslach. This is our future. He gave money all over, you'll see, all over every institution you can imagine. It's like, what can I tell you? It's like the judge, I was very moved, Rachel Freier. So someone sent me a link to her, an inauguration, a party, and I mean, you're in a court in Brooklyn, and in downtown Brooklyn, in the Supreme Court, and there's so many beards and payas and long clothes and family. You know I'm talking about Yitzchak, right? It was in Yediot, Friday had a big article. So I hear her speak. And she says how she tells her children that When you go into Manhattan, don't hide your payas. Let them see your payas. Proud, proud, unbelievable. Didn't hide anything. All right? In Switzerland, you can do whatever you want. In Israel, you are cramped in. The Rav, when they wanted him to come in Aliyah, Mr. Chris built all this. So one of the problems with the Rav, if you're familiar with Washington, and I published the correspondence there with the Rav, to please come, Rabbi Dr. Lenny Rosenfeld, people say, where did you get these letters? Fabulous. This 1,000 years from now, when they write the history of the period, these are golden letters. I said, thank God the family gave it to me. I didn't rob them. I got them with permission. So Ezra Rosenfeld, Zayn Gesund, married to my student. So you see, he's the Rav. You can see from the correspondence, how can I go to Israel? The Briskers will put me in Cheirim for my doctorate. If I utilize philosophic talks, PhD, could you imagine Hebrew U? They would have been dancing in the aisles. My family will put me in Cheirim. What do? Whichever way I turn. So you see, Lenny Rosenfeld is telling the Rav, there are enough YU type people here. Yes, when you come, they might make a Taharam, might yell, might shout, might demonstrate. But within a few months, it'll all be forgotten, and you'll be able to teach and do what you wish very easily. I don't think Lenny convinced the Rav. The problem was Heichal Shlomo, because it's Memanav Shach. Could you conceive of the Rav coming to Israel? Heichal Shlomo was then the center of the world. It's not today that Ari Rabbi Berman left Heichal Shlomo to take on the presidency of YU. In the 70s, I don't think you would have left Heichal Shlomo to take on the presidency of YU. It's more chashuv Heichal Shlomo. But could you conceive the Rav would come and not give a shir in Heichal Shlomo, the heart of Mizrahi, the chief rabbinate? Whenever I walked into Heichal Shlomo, I'd sit it. I shook. Look where I am. Today, lo aleinu, what can I tell you? But if the Rav would go into Heichal Shlomo, the Brisker Rav fought World War III with atom bombs answering Heichal Shlomo. And here his first cousin, his nephew is going in, his first, well, Brisker was alive, his first cousins, their cousins, their cousins going into Heichal Shlomo. So you see this now, Rav Hutman says the same thing, that if Europe and Palestine were the most fertile grounds for independence as a student, the United States would be the most fertile ground for independence as a teacher, a rabbi. You follow? In Israel, he was free. At that time, you could go to Hebron. You could go to Rav Kook. There wasn't the dichotomy you have today. My grandson once told me a Panovich kid came into Hakotel, and he meets my grandson in the lobby, you know, the way Hakotel is built, downstairs, you go upstairs, and he says, and then this guy starts talking, the Yeshkan Yeshiva Shamati, a Hezdi Yeshiva, they were speaking in Hebrew, obviously, and he says to my grandson, and what do you study here? And my grandson saw where he was from and where he was coming from. My grandson says to him, oh, we studied Kitvei Rav Kook, Kitvei Maharal. And then he tells him, Taleiti, come up with me and see. And a kid walks in, 1,000 kids are sitting in the Medrash, Shas, and Paiskim, Rishonim, Achronim. He was flabbergasted. So you see, there's a dichotomy today. It did not exist in the 1920s, the 1930s. And Rav Hutna, as a student, nothing was better. But then, as time marched on, the Mizrachistim and the Agudistim, the world started splitting. I don't have to tell you what we have today. Show me the last time you heard of a graduate of Shalavim going to Panovich. And Shalavim is one of the more right-wing Hesdi Yeshivas, right or wrong. Show me the last time you heard of a Karim Biafna graduate going to Panovich, going to Hebron. All right, Mir picks up because Mir is Parv to a certain degree. But Hebron, Panovich, it's a different world. Slabatka. Then you look at has the yeshiva, Mekas HaRav, HaMor, different worlds today. Rav Chutna said, in America, if I can paraphrase his comment, I can live like Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg in Switzerland. In America, the word he used, ani lo tzarich lihiz dahot. I don't have to define myself. I can be non-aligned. And I have to tell you, this was an unbelievable comment. That's exactly Rav Chutna. You cannot put him in the same breath, not with Rav Soloveitchik, not with Rav Moshe Feinstein, and we'll have a lot to talk about his relationship with Rav Moshe. You cannot put him in the same breath with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. You cannot put him in the same breath with Rav Aaron Cutler. He was unique. He understood it. He envisioned it. And all these aspects. He revealed himself, but he also hid. Anonymous. Not like the Rav. The Rav let the world know, black and white, who he was. Came to YU. Students laughed at him. Fought. You all know what went on. You've seen the documentary. You've read the Rav. Rakefet knows even more than he's published or allowed into the documentary. I know a great deal. Students were opposed to him.
Opposed
to who? The Rav, coming in 41, he represented to them the Agudas Harabonim, the phony Heksherim. What was going on in Boston. They believed that this is just when the charges are being pressed, that the Rav made money under the table. Unbelievable. Editorials in Commentator. You all know one issue of the Commentator. The fish, remember I told you, went into the Harlem River. The fish rejoiced. Okay. I have a copy. Maybe the only copy in the world. Maybe there are a few others. I don't know. I have a copy. Fish rejoiced. I know who wrote the article. Let me not reveal.
You're criticizing the writers?
No, criticizing me. I was 3 years old at the time. Criticizing, ripping the heck out of the Rav. You don't know students get hot under the collar. You understand?
They believed all the lies.
Here in Israel, students don't get so hot because by the time they finish army and reach university, they're anxious to get a degree. That's why there's very little liberal arts here. You understand? But in America, why you? What? Columbia? They locked for the 60s. They locked for Fed. They burned research papers. You know what went on? Read about the 60s. Vietnamese War. God have mercy, what went on? Make love, not war. Students? Question mark. Not Talmud. Maybe students. But the Rav came to yeshiva. Students are calling him by his initials. Oh, he has to establish who is he. He can't come out with a sefer on the Rambam. He can't come out with a sefer filled with chidushim. He's a brisker. Remember my lectures on brisk again 20 years ago. Remember my lectures or not? The brisker concept of has to be perfect, perfectionism. But that's when he published Ish HaLacha. Oh boy. When the Rav published Ish HaLacha, it appeared in 1944 in Talpiot. The world was shaking. The genius involved. But it wasn't Chidushim in Shas. This was philosophy. As Professor Tversky said many decades later, look at the sources the Rav quoted, the non-Torah sources. Look at the man's familiarity with contemporary philosophic writings. He didn't hide anything. He was like Rav Kook. Rav Chutna, on that level, was the Alter Rav Slabatka. You see, they were both influences on him. A very, very powerful point.
So who was the influence on the Rav? But he was his own influence.
There's no question that the influence on the Rav was his mother. His mother, I'll have to end with this. Wait till next week, you'll see what I have. I have a world here. There's no question, before he meets Reb Chaim Heller, who was a tremendous influence, his mother, the Feinstein family, that branch of the Feinstein family, was much more open. They describe Shabbos in the Feinstein house. I believe his sister, Shulamit Meiselman, she has part of it. But I heard also from the family. You see, compare the Shabbos table by Reb Chaim Brisker. By what could he talk about? Everything was in learning. His whole world was learning. The famous story I told you with the grocer. Remember the story? That Reb Chaim, Agudat Yisrael, 1912, had this preliminary meeting that was going to lead to Agudat Yisrael. So they invited all the Gedolim, this idea, all because everyone's becoming a Machal Shabbos. In unity, their strength. So Reb Chaim came, he attended, and he walked out. So they asked him, Rebbe, what were you so upset with? Remember his answer? That the German rabbi spoke for 40 minutes, 45 minutes, didn't mention one Maimon Chazal. And Reb Chaim told the story of this lady who moved to the new community, and she comes into this grocer, and there's a kid working there, a teenager. You remember your Yiddish? Haug de Bakken. Okay, go and explain that one. Challenged. I don't want to use the Hebrew word, it's not nice. They used the word mefager. But the challenged in Yiddish, haug de Bakken. Morty, remember the word? I'm not making it up. Okay. So, you know, half-baked. It's a fabulous word, by the way. It's better than any other language, but still, it's not nice. So she asked the kid, how much are the potatoes? The kid says, zwei zlotys. She asked the kid, how much are the oranges? Zwei zlotys. How much are the carrots? Zwei zlotys. No, it can't be. That's a Kenish sign. So she goes to the owner and she says to him, why is this kid answering me? Everything is two zlotys. He says, lady, I do a favor. This kid, you know, is a little challenged. I employ him, give him. Only two words he can say are two zlotys. So when you're ready, I'll give you the price. Reb Chaim said, ich kenne reden divrei teure. Ich kenne nicht an andere Sprach. I don't know another language, Reb Chaim said. Half hour, 45, that's why whenever I speak in public, I quote a Maimon Chazal. I don't want to embarrass my Rebbe, okay? Now you go to the Feinstein table. They were talking about the revolution, socialism, Bolshevikism, everything that was happening then, Hebrew literature. Not all of them remained from. Some of them became well-known maskilim. But the core remained from. But very, very open. By the way, Soloveitchik's too. The times were such that everyone remained from. Who's the president today? What's his name?
Soloveitchik.
Where's he president?
Yale.
Lang Kleinekite, the Machalo Shabbos, boasts that he's a Soloveitchik. And he Soloveitchik, I had Soloveitchik in Solanta Yeshiva with me. They were Eichet Soloveitchik.
How is he related to
A cousin, whatever.
Brothers, grandson.
Great-grandson. Poseidon, cousin. Like I'm related to Rabbi Revel. Rabbi Revel's grandparents are my great-great-grandparents, okay? As a matter of fact, I have Yotzeit tonight, but it's not, I have Yotzeit today for my grandmother, but it's not that grandmother who I'm related to, it's the other grandmother. So, you understand what we're saying? The Rav's mother gave him an openness. Ultimately, Reb Moshe, Bal Kochi Yane Amen. It's like all happy marriages. Ultimately, the man has to give in to his wife. She's smarter. Bina Yitei Rabbanashi. Can't argue with an open Gemara. By the time, who pushed him to Berlin? Oh, when he got to Berlin already, he was ripe for the influence of Reb Chaim Heller. You understand? It was, the fruit was ready to fall off the tree. And there's no question, Reb Chaim, the Rav's Derech Eretz for Reb Chaim was overwhelming. And who was Reb Chaim? I remember with the Sefer Mitzvah. You know, I told you, the Rav, it used to leave every shiur, you could take 20 minutes for loss.
Gedaf Shikana Yingel upstairs to Gottesman Library to bring him a sefer that he needs. It's not like today you had zero. You notice I never ask for a book any time. It's all Xeroxed in advance. Someone, well, once a rabbi came in here and looked, couldn't believe. I work very hard. These lectures right. You're absolutely right. You know how hard I work. You see me here every morning Xeroxing. What am I Xeroxing? I'm not Xeroxing the New York Times. I'm Xeroxing for my Shayorim. Could be even the New York Times if I need something from it. So the Rav one time, bring my Sefer Mitzvahs. Yeah, get up, go up, bring the Sefer Mitzvahs. The kid runs up, kid runs in. He brings him a standard Sefer Mitzvah. I name, Zogim, Vilfam, Rav Chaim, Hela, Kuknishtanam. I don't look at any other Sefer Mitzvah. Just Rav Chaim Hela. I have the original Rav Chaim Hela. Why? He edited from manuscript, translated from Arabic. You know Arabic, Mark? You know Arabic? What are you saying, Natan? You're going to translate? Reb Chaim Hela. So the Rav was right for that influence. But Rav Hutner never made it public. The Rav, there was nothing hidden about him. As I say, I put it in the Rav's mouth now, my life is an open book. There was nothing he did that he was ashamed of. All right, we have a lot more to do with the world. You have no idea what I've uncovered. And I even solved the problem of what happened at the end when Rav Hutner left Chaim Berlin. No one wants to talk about it. No one writes about it. But I kissed the computer. What the computer has, it's beyond words. Charlie, you are way beyond me. A PhD from... By the way... If you're a medical doctor, then doctor is a vocational title. You follow? When you sign your name, you're not allowed, you should not sign Dr. Charlie Hexter. You sign Charles Hexter, comma, PhD. Get it? The PhD then is a description of what you know, what you're doing in the world, but it's not a vocational title. And that's, remember we spoke about this last week, and I was right, that if you're not an MD, you should not use the title doctor. Yes, when you sign or you have stationery, if you need the title, so Charles Hexter, comma, PhD. Morty Tarrigan, comma, PhD. Professor, whatever. Oh, professor may be a vocational title. Right. See, that's different already. People call me, I'm embarrassed. I forget about what I said last week with doctor. That was done on purpose to give me a shtach. But people say that, I remember walking to the car, people come over and say, rabbi, doctor, professor, you know, they're doing it seriously. I say, look, when a person has too many titles, they become worthless. I say, one cancels the other. My name is Aaron. If you're my Talmud, you can call me Rebbe. Then you're not allowed to say Aaron. Okay, you have to say Rebbe. But, okay. Anyway, we'll come to it. We have, okay. To reiterate, what do we do today? We're continuing the journey of Rav Yitzchak Kutner. I am very in debt to Hillel Goldberg. Do you agree with me? You see these quotes from him are so powerful. His writing, I don't think he ever equaled the literary scholarship he put into this article on Rav Yitzchak Kutner. What we spoke about today, the early influences, but Rav Hutner himself, he recognizes in any country he's at home, within a year he knows the culture, knows the environment, knows the language, knows the dress. Multifaceted. The Alta and Rav Kook, the comparisons, the differences, how it impacts on Rav Yitzchak Kutner. Be'ezrat Hashem, next week you go further. Now I have to tell you, Sunday's class, I'm bringing in a source that will blow your minds. And I may tell you even more if the Malach says speak, I will speak. Yitzchak, it's going to cost you $36,000, linked to this shekel to the IOU list for that source. But to show you that I'm a good person, this is yours. And do you want to borrow this? I told you about it. I gave Haskam, it's coming out in a hardcover edition. when God becomes history, historical essays of Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, it's in your field. He deals here with Christianity. But do me a favor, you give it who you want to read it to. You give it back, we'll pass it on. Okay? Now,
how come he chucked Rav Cook? He didn't chuck Rav Finkel.
No, but you're right. We'll come to it. He chucked more than Rav Cook. You'll see. You'll see. I uncovered something. Solves all problems. Now, does anyone want this? I'm preparing. Morty, this may be of interest to you, of the literature background of your wife. I'm preparing lectures on Mir Yeshiva now. And this is the picture of Mir Yeshiva and the names of the students. Very fascinating. This is from Hong Kong, from when they were in Shanghai, when they were exiled to Shanghai, and they're inside their yeshiva there. It's a famous picture. By the way, Rav Henoch Fishman is not in the picture. He wasn't feeling well that day. And in my picture in my office of the Smusmachim of 61, Avraham Lamb is not there. He wasn't feeling well that day. So I want to tell anyone listening, if you don't feel well and they're taking a picture that may be historic 100 years later, make it your business to get there. These are two Chabad stories on the Rebbe. I know this is fascinating, Rabbi Moshe Gutnick. And you got to read this about naming names. And Alex will have no problem. He'll say, Ruach HaKodesh. Nebuch, Amon, Litvak, it's beyond
the
words.
The Rav speaks about Ruach HaKodesh.
I know,
but the Rav
also said, Chobnish kan Ruach HaKodesh. This is the article that has caused so much discussion on Open Orthodoxy. It's another copy. So many people sent it to me. And I don't know why everyone's getting upset. What do you expect on out of Chovevei Torah? They've already proven what they think. But this is another copy of the article. This, if anyone wants, this is a chapter from a book on presidential courage by Michael Beschloss. I quoted this last week about Harry Truman and Jacobson. Very fascinating. And at the end, it's when Harry Truman says, I am Cyrus, I am Cyrus. And finally, and you got to read it.
I can understand that.
It's very interesting, that chapter. Finally, I want to end off with something from Making of a Gadol. A dolphin sent it to me, but I know he was altogether very humble. He's talking about Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Brisker. But, and he tells the story. This is demonstrated by a story told by his son, Reb Moshe. Reb Chaim had visited him at Pesach time, when nuts are distributed to children. Reb Moshe's oldest son, Yosef Baer, only 2 years old, had rolled a nut into a hole in the ground with too narrow an opening to get his finger into it to pull the nut out. So he poured water into the hole and the nut floated up. Reb Moshe pointed out the child's cleverness to his father. And Reb Chaim rejoined seriously, quote, "Thus is garnished, that means nothing. When I was an infant, I also showed a lot of cleverness, yet nothing became of me. The same may happen to him." Okay, quote, end quote. My dear students, another class will be coming in. I want to thank you for making me young. I met a student yesterday, an old Rifka. I was surrounded by students of all ages. The eldest one there looks about 20 years older than I do today, and he was my student. And what we make a cheshbon in 1963. And then everyone asked me, how do I feel? I said, well, I feel like an old man, but tomorrow morning I'm going to be very young again. And I want to thank you very much. I want to wish a good trip to Natan. Mazal Tov, a friend is getting married. I want to wish a good trip to Charlie, who's doing the mitzvah of Kibbutz Aviyim. and I want to welcome one half of the Shurin family, and in, I see another face that I don't know yet, but I will know in a minute, and until we meet again in health and happiness, das verdammt. Thank you.